go, people. Okay, well, welcome everybody to a very special episode of Counterspin. Of course, Calvin and I are on the road for the Let's Not Forget 2022 tour. And we've currently stopped in Thames and we're on our way to Tauranga for the event on Friday. So hopefully this interview will reach you in quick time because it's a really, really important information because our special guest is Dr. Tal Braun. And many of you will have seen, of course, the recent interview with Dr. Ardis on the Stu Peters show, Watch the Water, and that's kind of gone viral. And of course, he's done lots of interviews since then. But Dr. Tal Braun is actually the doctor who figured it out before Dr. Ardis, and he is... he's a US National Counterterrorism and EMS Advisor and Trainer, Chief Scientist, Counter Bioterrorism Division, and he's a biochem engineer, Executive Director of the Violence Prevention Agency and Clinical Psychologist. Welcome to the show, Dr. Tal Braun.
Thank you, Hannah. It's great to be here. And I guess part of always hearing my credentials is to tell people a couple of things. One is, I think the primary importance of credentials is that I'm a human being. I'm a human being that still cares. I think that we're going to have, like any other time period where we now are trying to, all desperately trying to seek for truth. One of the things is credentials are useful and credentials are also useless. In terms of us pulling back from, our capturers want us using their credentials, and they're very excited to tell us that we need to trust them because their credentials, but they don't allow for any other credentials. And so we actually, it's interesting because part of the sort of litmus test that we're all doing now is credibility through who you are, what you're currently doing, who can vouch for you, and what level we feel someone really cares about the problem and the people that it's affecting. I mean, look, you know, going through a lot of old footage of some of the interviews with people that had created this bioweapon. And one thing that I'm able to see is somebody that's trained to look out for psychopaths is just high levels of psychopathy in the way that they talk about, whether it's the animal experiments or what this could do to the world, or, you know, sort of joking about moving this proline over here and putting this proline just because they can. There's the smugness and this arrogance and this godlike, persona that they're all trying to put out. But what's missing from it is soul. What's missing from it is the part of the human drama that they don't understand. That's also how we beat them. So within that credentials, I'm glad people will know the kind of work that I do, but I really want people to know me as somebody that cares. And, you know, the only reason that I'm doing these interviews in the first place is to really get out information that saves lives. And that doesn't only mean in a physical way, but the threat to worldwide democracy and the threat to our own preservation of values is really what's currently at threat. I think that on a core level, people like yourself really understand that this is long term, that once this is gone, you know, who knows when it comes back, if it comes back. And when I say it, I mean the ability to survive and live on a planet where you are empowered, where you are the master of your destiny rather than someone else being the master of your slavehood.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what the majority of our audience understands that. And it's good to have people with your expertise. And I agree with you in terms of having letters after your name or whatever isn't the be all and end all, because of course the psychopaths, they thrive on that. They thrive on, you know, compartmentalizing information so that all these experts are constantly speaking out, and somehow that's got more credibility. But I think you're right. You know, it's kind of like we have to transcend our own expertise and like reconnect with our own heart and soul and really have a deep care for humanity and life on this planet. And yeah, that is why we do what we do. And this interview is about trying to help people understand and get clarity around all this information that's been thrown at us and try and find truth. And yeah, it's, I think, a good place to start. I suppose I thought about bringing up, you know, that Vanity Fair interview that came out a few weeks ago, and it was talking about Dr. Fauci and, of course, what was happening in Wuhan and gain of function. And that has been a track that many people have been on in terms of trying to figure out what's really going on with this bioweapon. And it's now
let me start there and something that I can do differently here that I've been really itching to do. I think that common sense people, and I've spent some time in Australia, looking forward to one day getting to New Zealand when it's no longer sort of the hub of all of this bio warfare activity. I don't know if you've been tracking, but an interesting statistic or a story that you can do in the future with some people is that New Zealand at one stage, I would assume that it still is, just in terms of it might have slowed down during the pandemic, but at one stage New Zealand was the hub and fastest growing prepper community in the world in terms of the amount of money that was being spent by people that had left Silicon Valley or that were going to leave Silicon Valley and use New Zealand and bought up, of course, eventually they said they stopped the land grab, but they grabbed enough land to really build the modern day equivalent of bunkers. And basically they got on their private jets and they went to New Zealand, and a lot of them are still there. And they are now hubs of I'd call them the biosynthetic capital of the world, is starting to take place in Australia. And the tech side of it is being run from Australia and New Zealand. So you're right in the center. I wouldn't call it the center, but you're at the hub, the sort of in my security terms or tactical officer terms of the trading I do, you'd call it either a command post or the GSOC. This idea that it's an operating center where instructions are being given, and that should fascinate anybody, because the last place anybody would have assumed would be that would be running out of New Zealand and Australia. But strategically, and where it's placed, and it's pristine land and it's fertile lands and it's meat in particular, which we should cover as well in this interview, makes New Zealand and Australia a really good command center to literally be part of a takeover, and they're there, which is kind of scary for all of you. It's the reason why there's such a heavy-handedness. I don't know why. It might be the background to New Zealand and Australia, but the words that are coming to mind, particularly in this interview, is sort of the slave owner and slaves and prisons and prisoners as a way for people can understand globally what's taking place. And I think the scary part for New Zealanders and Australians is that because it's a hub of an operating center, the heavy-handedness is really operational security. I mean, it really is being protected and has become extremely violent in its pursuit to keep those safe havens going for people to fly in and out of, right? And the scrutiny that it's very difficult for people to even imagine that Australia, and New Zealand have become these places of such high level of oppression. When something that should have made people just stop in their tracks worldwide, and I don't think most people are even aware of this, is that Gavin De Becker, who's known as the top security professional in the world. I mean, this is somebody who his agency, his organization is the best of the best in terms of protective details and in terms of looking after high net worth people and elites and business people and judges. He is the best in the world and a fantastic ethical organization. They are really good at what they do. For him to go on Joe Rogan And the sentence I'm going to paraphrase is that he doesn't think he'll ever go to Australia ever again. This is the top security professional in the world. Like, what does that even mean? I want to be able to say, Gavin, what are you even talking about? And I understand what he's saying, but to hear him say that was so shocking to me, because it means that he's reading the situation the same way as I am. And he's even more extreme in his viewpoint, because when he said he doesn't think he'll go there again, he's not saying, oh, this might take a while. I hope to go to Australia next year. He's saying, I don't think I can ever go to Australia again. I mean, that should be terrifying, not only to you living in that side of the world, but to everybody. I mean, what is that? What does that even mean?
Because of the tyranny that has just unfolded over in Australia and here in New Zealand, that there's just like, we literally, and we're so apathetic, you know? So I think we've allowed ourselves to become, you know, good little slaves.
Well, this is the best word that I'd agree with you and say that the best word is tyranny. And I would also say, okay, let's go back in history and have a look at these Commonwealth countries and their ties to the Commonwealth. And then let's pretend for a moment that all of the deals that were made, where it looked like places became independent and they got their cute little flags and they got their own national anthems and they got their own sovereignty. Let's pretend that was just on paper. You know, the sort of model of de jure and de facto, right? Your paper version of something it should be very interesting for people to see that the countries that have been the most involved in this pandemic, the most involved in vaccine development, the most involved in pushing the vaccine, have all been Commonwealth countries. Have a look at how involved the UK is, South Africa, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, right? You know, you could almost assume that for a while they were allowed the appearance of sovereignty. And then the takeover is being run out of these hubs. India, of course, is also on that list, but the Indians have pushed back so hard and for so long that India is remaining one of the strongholds. They've pushed back. I mean, they just won a Supreme Court ruling in India that the vaccines are not constitutional, right? So they are fighting hard and they are not putting up with a form of colonization. It's interesting to see if they'll be able to still keep up a sort of Gandhian passive approach. But I think sitting next to a nuclear country like Pakistan and sitting as being the hub of most pharmaceuticals in the world, and with you know, sort of a very different mentality of, okay, well, you allowed us to have our freedom, but maybe they were the only country that was de jure and de facto, meaning that maybe they were the only sovereign one that made it out. You know, I think somebody should look at Canada. And so you're definitely not a sovereign nation. I mean, it's beyond doubt to anybody that these places are being run by tyrants. Your New Zealand's fascinating for me too, because the sort of idea of what people call zero COVID and the lockdowns. I want to point out something to New Zealanders that should have been obvious to Australia and New Zealand. Before the vaccines arrived, New Zealand especially could never have had a COVID problem. You do not have a coronavirus problem in New Zealand because of your UV. At any given time in the world, your UVC from the sun, at any given time, seasonally, in any day of the week, you have the highest UVC in the world. It literally melts coronavirus, and it's not the heat. Right, coronaviruses are particularly resistant to acidity, and they do okay. They don't do great with heat, like most proteins. You know, you heat them up, they start denaturing. But the wavelength of light that destroys coronaviruses is UVC, and at the highest, it's the highest in the world. So you would have never, absolutely ever, had a coronavirus problem. And instead, Arden, you know, comes along and says, oh, you know, we have to lock down this place. We're going to keep all of these. There's going to be no COVID. Look how great we're doing. Look, our numbers are so low. Then all of a sudden you start getting vaccines and you start having cases. You would have never physically, scientifically, it would have been impossible for New Zealand to ever have an issue until those vaccines arrive.
Yeah.
And of course, every fact checker in the world is going to be like, oh, he's talking nonsense. Okay, well, do the math. Plot the graphs, have a look at UBC, have a look at pollution. And the Chinese were the first to know that there's a direct link between UBC and pollution. And they started spraying their skies. They literally do what they do with pollution over there, and they increase the spraying of the skies to bring down the particles of pollutants and to start letting in UVC as a natural mitigation strategy. So I just looked at New Zealand and I looked at what Arden was doing, and I was like, okay, well, you're the greatest PR. You know what you did as a DJ. You know how to bullshit a club. You know how to bullshit the line outside a club, and you know how to create the appearance that you've got a good party going on. Because as a background as a DJ, you know how to work the system. A DJ is a master manipulator in a great way, you know. But those skills then used to run a whole country, then you know exactly how to do promotional material and how to bullshit people. But the science always, the science will always get through that nonsense. It has to. That is the truth.
Yeah. So there's just so much to unpack there. Yeah. She's just had everybody in a complete spell. Her veneer is wearing off because I think because she's lying so much, her body is not mirroring what she's saying, and people are just actually now having such a vile reaction to her. They can no longer actually watch her because she spoke about being kind, and she just did this fake, oh, we care about you, and yet we're going to destroy your country, we'll destroy your small businesses, we'll not allow you to go and hug your neighbors. And all because, yeah, one case and her great crusade to have zero tolerance for COVID. I just want to go back to this idea. We could take it so many ways, but spraying, you talk about spraying, like in New Zealand, there's a lot of spraying in the skies. Now, can you just get into a little bit more about what you mean about that and what are they spraying?
Well, I don't know what they're spraying in New Zealand. And I also don't, you know, I think what Brian Artis did was a true gift to the world in highlighting something that's absolutely provable in terms of the venom on the spike protein. The genomic sequence was literally handed to us. Whether that was a real genomic sequence or that's the fabricated genomic sequence, it is the genomic sequence that then got used as the patents laid out way before the pandemic. It becomes the spike protein that was then used for the vaccine. So let's assume that the genomic sequence is accurate, and let's assume based on the symptoms of an envenomation, sort of the idea of it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. If the genomic sequence spells out venom, right, it has these venom peptides on it. People get confused about why the words cobra and crate are used. They are used because they're the closest matches to what those venom are. But are they cobra and crate? Do they come, you know, milked from a snake? No, they are synthetic peptides. The equivalent would be you go to your mate's house and this person has this expensive leather sofa, and you're very confused because one, your mate's a vegan, and two, your mate would never spend that kind of money on a leather sofa. So you say, what's up with the sofa? And your mate says, yeah, isn't this great? And you say, but you know, when did you get into leather? And when would you spend this kind of money on leather? And your mate says, no, this is faux leather. It looks like leather, smells like leather, but it's not leather. Well, it's the same thing. This is looks like venom, smells like venom, works like venom, but is it milked from a creature? No, it's made. It's manufactured and it's made by microbes. You can make venom from different microbes. Bacteria can make venom and do make venom naturally, even to the point where your own natural immune system, these things called phages, is pretty much the best way to synthesize venom. In terms of my work as part of looking at this as a bioweapon, took a deep dive into the aspect of venom and some of the other crucial sort of death mechanisms. But I wasn't the person who ever said it's in the water. I did send a letter to the FBI explaining that my findings are not only is the spike protein the issue, and raising the alarm that they are now going to take that same spike protein and put that into people's bodies and call it a vaccine. They had to change the definition of the vaccine, by the way, which shows you also the global reach that the CDC changes the word vaccine, which is a standard definition for a long time in the medical and scientific community. Then it doesn't match this vaccine, so they just change it, right? This is what psychopaths do. They change the rules and they can do whatever they want. But if you try and do the same thing, right, then you get deleted, or you're the worst person. But they can give themselves permission to change all kinds of things. It's how you win any game in the world, by cheating, right? If everyone else is not cheating and you cheating, the cheat will always win. And so I was never the person who said it's in the water or in sprays. But I did look at it, and I did find the mechanics of this spike protein could be aerosolized, meaning that you can take a venom, you could take the spike protein, and you could essentially put that into particles that are very, very stable, and they could be put into water, and it would remain viable, and you could spray it in the air, and it would remain viable. And the giveaway to anybody that thinks doubt your audience would say, well, that's too, sounds too far-fetched. The giveaway to everybody on the planet in that, why that's possible and highly likely, is that we already have an example of an aerosolized water particle molecule of venom that's stable. And we have that. It's called the spitting cobra. The spitting cobra takes venom and it spits it from its mouth. It moves several feet in the air and lands up on prey. And the method it's using is it wants to get into the eyes of the prey. But if it lands up on the skin, it will have an effect on that prey. It will obviously target the eyes as a way of getting very quickly into the bloodstream of the animal. But there's an example of how easy it is to visualize that's very possible. So when I wrote to the FBI in June of 2021, I said, I'm concerned that this bioweapon can be used with or without the virus. And the virus is only one transportation method. And I was also very concerned, and still am, that these spike proteins can be aerosolized. And that doesn't preclude me saying that aerosol can land up on food. It can land up in the water supply. It can land up as being part of, the wind that blows around the world, which is how viruses move around anyway. It should alert somebody that all I was trying to say is that the protein itself can be dispersed, and that this is a pathogenic substance, and they ought to be looking into, where this is coming from and what is being used to mitigate the risk for people. So when you said, what are they spraying in New Zealand? I have no idea whether they're doing a mitigation strategy of whether they're using chemicals like they use in China, that they literally spray the air to bring down heavy particles to stop pollution. I very much doubt that that's what's going on in New Zealand. I also don't want to add to any rumors of chemtrails or centrails or anything else. If it's happening, some people will know about it. If it's not happening, I certainly don't have an opinion one way or another. I think it is a good segue for me to say that something fascinating that people should know about venom is that it was the original chemtrail and still is the original chemtrail. Venom is a chemtrail. It's used by creatures. Marine creatures have some of the most toxic venom. They're called conotoxins, and they will actually spray out glucose as a scent to bring in the prey closer. And so that is a true form of when people talk about, whether chemtrails exist or not, in nature, everything exists. And then as human beings, can we manufacture these things for nefarious intent? Absolutely. I believe that the chemtrails that we use to draw people into these vaccines used a very similar principle of luring people in using glucose. The idea of telling people you're going to get a donut. As stupid as it sounds, that may have been actually the thing that reminded somebody to go and get their vaccine that day. If they were going to get a slice of pizza or a donut or any other, you know, high form of carbohydrate, for some people that were at risk to adverse reactions to that vaccine, that is a lure. That is a chemtrail that is documented. I mean, here in New York City, they went as far as even using Shake Shack, the burger franchise, you know, was giving out free burgers. I mean, it literally, we've become like fish, you know, with being enticed by a lure. It's like, oh, look at that thing. That looks delicious, that burger. That's a good opportunity for me to go and get that burger. And at the end of it is a hook. And at the end of it is death and destruction. We are being fished.
Yeah, they did that here in New Zealand too, and it was disgusting because they were doing that for the children, and they had ice cream and the lure of winning a free iPad, and of course that causes a whole chemical reaction when you're on the devices. So the kids just want the hit, and they know what it feels like to be on a device, and if their parents had any doubt, then the kids just nag their parents to go and get jabbed.
And there you go if that person did it for any other reason besides them saying that it's for a, you know, a health product, right? At the end of the day, what they're offering is a commercial product that they're saying is for someone's health. If it was for anyone else, like you, every person would go like, what are you doing? You're driving around the neighborhood, enticing these kids into your van, right? And then you're giving them stuff. You're giving them a toxic substance. Like, this is the method of drug dealers. This is the method of pedophiles. Like, literally those techniques, you know, they're driving around giving out free ice creams and using technology to lure our kids and then giving them a toxic substance. I mean, it is literally the most toxic substance on the planet is that vaccine. I mean, any scientist in the world who says it's not is either completely ignorant, all right, or completely the worst liar on the planet. You know, that they could lie with a straight face means, you know, I shouldn't call them a worst liar. They're really good liars because scientifically they know that the spike is pathogenic. Otherwise, why would it cause such a crazy immune response? Right? It's built to create an immune response, meaning it's pathogenic.
So can you talk a little bit and explain about how it works? Because it doesn't affect everybody the same. And nobody really knows the full content of this jab, do they?
No. And also there is now at least some information from people getting documents from organizations like Pfizer. It's interesting, but the documents that I would go after they keep releasing Pfizer documents rather than Moderna. Moderna owns the bioweapon. You know, Pfizer is the profiteer that allows for this to feel medical and allowed for people to trust, because Pfizer has been around for a long time. Doctors knew the word Pfizer. Our drugs are from Pfizer. Pfizer sponsors everything. But there would have been hesitancy if this new company that didn't have a single product on the market, Moderna, that had ties to the Department of Defense of the U.S. Government, you know, a military-funded operation. You have this startup company, this massively funded hedge fund startup company, originally funded through military money, biodefense money, and then they bring that product to market. So the vaccines that are much more lethal and are having much more adverse reactions is actually Moderna. But yet I'm only seeing documents released by Pfizer. I keep seeing lawyers go after and they'll, you know, get the information and people will, where's the Moderna documents? You know, where is the adverse reactions from the actual bioweapon side? There's a much higher load of the spike protein. And in my opinion, it's more pathogenic than the Pfizer document. How it works and why it affects certain people. I'm going to use the word, some of this is starting to be proven. Some of it's already proven, but I'm also going to talk about hypotheticals, because at this point, nobody knows, including the FDA, including the CDC, including your versions in New Zealand, including every single person in the world actually does not know the results of this experiment. And we may never know in our lifetime, right? You and I might be long gone when we finally understand what this was and how awful it was. It's going to take a long time, right? Purposefully, you know, some of this is very purposeful, so that wouldn't be fast acting, right? It's much harder to notice change when change is gradual over time, right? I mean, I only notice that I'm getting older when I look at to my friends and I'm like, what do you mean they're getting married? Or what do you mean they just started driving? Like, aren't they five? They're like, no, dude, they've grown up now. You know, when change is slow, it's not a shock to our system. And so we don't notice as much, right?
It's that whole analogy of putting the frog in the pot of cold water and slowly turning the heat up, and it never realizes, so it doesn't jump out. And by the time it's boiling, it's too late.
Exactly. And that's this idea that you know, we are programmed, our brains neurologically are programmed to notice the things that are odd, the things that are off, and mostly the things that are moving, you know, not moving gradually. That you know, it's like, you know, the deer was, you know, from a hunting point of view, like the animal was over there, now it's not over there. Oh, it could be behind me. I should look behind me. Our brains are very purposeful in being sentinels, but gradual changes are not that relevant over a lifespan. So the interesting thing is how this works and why it affects certain people is that a missing part where you know that you're dealing with a bunch of psychopathic liars is they made this seem like this was this disease that spread around the world. They never included things like coronaviruses are destroyed by UVC, like I mentioned, or the fact that coronaviruses are genetic. So for anybody that wanted to take a really fast read in understanding coronaviruses, go to something like Wikipedia, look up a feline coronavirus. And, you know, these are not new. The word novel was thrown in front of a coronavirus to make people feel like we were working a new problem, right? And it also allowed people to go, well, you know, if we could make a vaccine for this, then why don't we have great coronavirus vaccines for animals? Because we have much lower standards than what you can do to an animal to get to a fine working product. Well, how come it didn't really work out? And how come how come your vaccine killed certain animals or certain pedigree, let's say a pedigree cat is at much more high risk for a coronavirus than a cat with diversity in it, right? You're sort of cats, just like human beings. You know, this all comes down to gut bacteria diversity. And so the risk factor here for human beings of SARS-CoV-2, that these, you know, I want to call them a combination of medical morons and psychopaths. The thing that I never told people is that at any given time, the risk factor was chromosome 3, a sequence of genes of chromosome 3 that mostly have to do with the metabolism of sugar. So now you should start seeing why there's a high risk for people that are, one, obese, or have diabetes that's unmanaged, or have a metabolic disease that they're trying to figure out. It's the same set of genes. So there's an absolute cruelness to this in terms of the fact that just like kids do in a school, you know, they pick on the kid that's sick, or they pick on the fat kid. Well, these medical murderers have done the same thing. They've gone out, they found a subset of people that are going to be high risk to sugar metabolism. They've created a spike protein that is a sugar disruptor. They've attached it to a virus to make sure that it can spread. And then they've said, oh, look over here, everyone's dying. In fact, the majority of people that were dying were obese. Then you have another subset of people that were dying, which were old people. And those old people were dying with COVID, not from COVID. So in other words, when you didn't move a person for a few days out of their bed and they got bed sores, or when somebody was not feeding them, then they're going to die. You're literally offing them. You literally are culling human beings. And you're saying, look, they died from coronavirus. No, they didn't. They died from neglect. Or when it wasn't working fast enough, look, we tried. We stuck them on a ventilator. Well, why were they on a ventilator in the first place? For a metabolic disorder, you're not going to fix it with a ventilator. Oh, they were staying on the ventilator for too long. Oh, let's use remdesivir. Anybody that's sick and put on remdesivir will be dead within 3 days. I mean, you can take a top athlete anywhere in the world, right, and put them on remdesivir for a short amount of time, and they're going to start having kidney issues. And potentially you're going to kill them over a couple of weeks. A top peak performer. So can you imagine taking somebody that's, 93 years old, has all kinds of comorbidities, is weak, hasn't been outside for 2 years. They don't have what we call vitamin D, which, I love marketing terms because you can use them in reverse. Oh, don't worry about vitamin D. Well, imagine if we actually called vitamin D what it is, a steroid hormone. Vitamin D is a steroid hormone.
Right.
So when somebody's vitamin D tanks, let's say from an old person who's, 96 years old, right, and you don't let them outside, well, now they don't have a steroid hormone that's involved in their immune system. Of course, they're going to die. And so they found ways of culling. And unfortunately, I'm actually starting to look at some of the data now that's happening in China. And I think that China has woken up to the fact that somehow they can also be involved in this culling of their aged, which are very expensive members of our population. And unless it's a culture that reveres their aged, like some cultures do, taking out your sick and vulnerable during wartime gives you an advantage. And so if you have a look, I watched a video, I think it was either this morning or late last night, it was out of China, where they were putting a person in a body bag. They put the person in a hearse, and they had to stop the hearse because this old person was still alive.
Oh, gosh.
In a body bag.
Wow.
Right? And now that person is now in critical care in a hospital, and they took them out of the body bag.
Oh.
But if that's not a sign of what is actually taking place, that this is a culling of our elderly, right? There's nothing more that I can say than a giveaway of evidence. Like, literally, it's like murderers that are caught, digging a grave and opening the trunk of a car. I mean, this is a hearse with a live person in.
Insane.
Okay, so in as far as the chromosome 3, this is a sugar disruptor. And people that are the venom, what the venom does is it disrupts the ability to use glucose, and glucose becomes the fuel, the toxin that starts feeding the bacteria that are literally trying to decompose a body. Venom has many functions, but one of which is defense. An animal will use venom to keep an attacker or a predator or somebody that stood on it by mistake. It'll use it defensively, and it'll also use it as capture. And then the third aspect of venom is decomposition. It will decompose. Venom allows the reason that venom is so powerful and potent is they are just molecular switches. They tell the body to switch over to different processes. And then the human body, or the animal in this case, takes over. And so the energy is coming from the prey. So think about what these pharmaceutical companies have done to use our energy against us. I'll give, your question is around how does this work? I'll start off with the part that I might forget to say, but I think is sort of the juiciest around people visualizing how evil this is. We mentioned the sort of sugar craving, right? People with a higher risk of severe COVID, one of the easiest ways to know if somebody's going to be at high risk or not is a person who likes a sweet tooth. A person who has a sweet tooth will actually be at a higher risk to somebody who likes bitter food. So you can already tell that venom has biological features to it that act similar to things like when talk about pheromones or scent. There are chemical propositions of proteins and venoms that are enticing, right? So part of something that I wanted to mention to you in this interview, because of the horrific sort of very, very heavy-handedness, and I want to call out the New Zealand police. And I just want to say to people that, I'm a law enforcement trainer. And when I see videos of law enforcement aiding and abetting in crimes, right, it's never too late. It's never too late for law enforcement to say no. It's never too late to literally use the chain of command and say, this has crossed the line. Even a military soldier is never instructed to do anything that defies codes of war. And so police officers have mechanisms and unions have mechanisms. And it's time that we get law enforcement back on the side of the people. They've weeded out, unfortunately, over time, and they've used incidents like a Christchurch to literally dispose of good people from great organizations. And when those people are not around, it gets much harder to retain the good people. So those people start going. And what you land up with are henchmen, right? You land up with people that are soulless doing the work. And then you also land up with people that are caught up in that bad system and are doing their best. And we need to focus on those people who have not lost their moral compass. And we need to say it's not too late. And then we need to support those brothers and sisters and being able to say, if you're so against this, we will support you. You're about to lose your pension because you don't want to do this. This community's got you. We're going to raise funds so that you don't have to be caught up in this. Like, we really do need to support those that are unwilling participants. And I think the threat of starvation is a pretty good threat. I think losing your livelihood or not being able to support your family, it's a big deal for people. It will make most people still go to work. It will force most police officers to go and put on riot gear and then take out their frustrations or their pain on that moment, right? I mean, we are human. This is a human drama. So we need to be supportive and be compassionate on why that's, you know, why some people are not jumping out of the system. We can't be unreasonable and think, oh, everyone can hit the road or everyone will go through this. We all have very different circumstances. Let me drill down on a component that I've hardly discussed anywhere as far as venom and as far as this spike protein is built. There is enough evidence, at least in my mind, to look at this thing and look at how it's working and know that part of what the nicotinic receptors do, where this venom is binding, is the same as a cigarette smoker. The majority of people, what nicotine is going to do is it's going to take the edge off things. Otherwise, people wouldn't smoke, right? The trade-off here is, oh, it could give me cancer. Okay, but look how good it makes me feel. It takes the edge off. I don't feel as suicidal, or I won't punch my boss in the face today. I'm going to go and take a smoke break. And when I come back, you know, those feelings of punching this guy in the face are gone. This venom is hitting those same receptors. So you could think of it as a riot control. You could think about it as compliance. Everyone talks about the death toll here or depopulation. It may not actually be as sinister. That might be collateral damage. That might be part of a bigger agenda. But in a much easier way to see is, could this be being used in the same way as if you handed out nicotine to everyone? Could it be used as a way of getting people compliant as the economic system changes? So in other words, is it being used as the same way as laughing gas is used in a dentist office? Is it taking away the feeling that people should fight back as cryptocurrency comes in? Is it taking away the feeling that people should be doing something about the genocide or the genocide that's taking place with the elderly? Is it literally taking the edge off as they literally read the Great Reset, as they flatten out the population and they reset us and make us animals and then take over and dominate us? Is it taking the edge off? Is it a tranquilizer? Is it being used in the same way as when you're trying to travel with a dog that gets a little car sick and someone says, well, the vet prescribed tranquilizer? Is this Mao Zedong's version of the opiate for the people?
So there could be, like, as always with these psychopaths, they have like a multi-pronged approach to things. So they've got, yeah, like a potential sedative type thing. And then what with the nanotech, the nanobots or whatever that they've got in there that could potentially pick up frequencies as well. There could be a whole lot of things that this serum is going to do, right?
Yeah. And I haven't even begun to explore some of the nanotechnology, or when people talk about graphene oxide. You know, for me, that's all interesting and I try and stay well-versed in it. But I won't go near it until I am definitive on things. So, for example, when I just talked about the psychological aspects to nicotine or to nicotinic receptor, that's factual. If these things are hitting the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, there are neurological and psychological effects. I can prove that in a court of law. I can prove that in a lab. I can prove. So I stay away from the stuff that's interesting and plausible and more than likely true and going there. But for me, they become they're easy they're much easier for fact checkers to try and get me, or they're much easier in terms of me trying to find evidence that's not quite there yet. I think that that's what's also interesting is that there's purposeful manipulation of the way that that the patents are put in, or the way they get approval on things, is that even if you sort through these documents and you try and look for the things you're looking for, you're going to find a lot of different words being used. They will mess with definitions. For example, gain of function. Right, that term gain of function is really interesting because it has been used by humans as a way of saying I can increase the function of something, but it is also a natural biological process. Our bodies are under gain of function all the time. Viruses are under gain of function. So when they will say this isn't a gain of function experiment, what we should do is not try and prove that it is using that definition. We say, well, then what is it? Right? Because that's how they win. They'll say, this doesn't fit this box anymore. Okay, well, what box does it now fit? If you're now using venom peptides that are natural, and now you're not synthesizing chemicals, well, then yes, you're right. It doesn't fit these definitions anymore. And so we need to keep up with the way that they're playing with that. When you talk about frequency, I think what's interesting is over time, we also get more and more comfortable with technology. Like I remember my grandfather used to say, no, I don't want that food. It's been made in the microwave. I can taste the waves. Maybe he could, right? Maybe he could, or he didn't like the fact that his food was being cooked in a way that he didn't understand, or that didn't make sense to him, or he preferred to see it done old school. And there was a psychological feeling to him that that food tasted different. Or maybe he was highly sensitive to the fact that there might be molecular differences between the way things are cooked. And I think that this is going to be similar. I think part of the way that they're winning over us is that we all assume that most people are uncomfortable with toxins. We're taking toxins with everything we do. I've got a cell phone in front of me that's giving out, harmful frequency. I'm okay with it. It's a trade-off for me. But I'm making a trade-off based on informed consent. I'm also making a trade-off that I believe that this agenda of you and I being able to connect in this way is useful for me. But if there was ill will in this kind of technology, I'd want to know about it and I'd want it to feed it. If this was enslaving me rather than freeing me, I find it pretty freeing to be talking to somebody in New Zealand. If it was enslaving me, I would throw it out the window and I wouldn't want to use it again. And I think that that's another way that they're winning. They're not allowing us to think about the choices that we're making. Even if you told somebody that this vaccine wasn't safe, wasn't effective, but it made them able to keep their friends and family, for a lot of people, that would be perfectly fine. The risk of losing their friends and family would be much more severe for them as a fear than any virus or any repercussions of an adverse reaction. So we should drill down on what it is that they're using as psychological techniques, because then that's the way we win.
Yeah. And just before we get to that, can I just ask? Yeah. So the vaccine is a bioweapon. So, and I just want to clarify for people who, again, maybe come into this information early or, for the first time, that the SARS-CoV-2, so that is a souped up bioweapon as well, do you think? Or what's happened there?
From what I can see and from what some of the papers are showing is that SARS-CoV-2 is SARS-CoV-1 with a new spike protein.
Yeah.
And SARS-CoV-1 came from a bat. Yep. And SARS-CoV-1 came from a copper mine, which is actually very relevant, which most people just leave out. But it told me something. I was doing a ton of work around copper and zinc as a way to defeat viruses. And so I looked at this thing and I thought, well, that's interesting. If it's come from a bat that's been in a copper mine, then it can withstand very, very high levels of copper. And so copper in our body, copper and zinc is naturally used to defeat viruses, which would mean that you need higher levels of copper and zinc to defeat this, not less, because it's resistant to the methods that would normally kill it. So even that information is crucial and understood. I think that some of the research I showed, and I couldn't verify this, but some people had said that they found copper in the vaccines, which would make sense that that would be part of, one, decreasing the adverse reactions, and two, that actually might also be helping to stop severe disease in those that were at risk. Increasing their copper would be very useful, especially when people have been taking zinc. One of the things that you've heard along the way is that everybody has been told to take zinc. You cannot take zinc without taking copper as a supplement. So that's really interesting that this virus, the original SARS-CoV-1, is particularly resistant to copper. And then the way to visualize this, my metaphors go all over the place depending on who I'm talking to. In this case, I want to use a car. The SARS-CoV-1, it's the vehicle, right? It's one of the ways that you can deploy the spike protein. So let's look at this and you just, say, okay, well, you've got this Toyota Camry. Right. And it's a silver Toyota Camry. And that's called, let's call that SARS-CoV-1. You attach a magnet to the top, like you have with the delivery signs, right? Going out and delivering pizza or whatever it is. You call that the spike protein. Okay. That's attached to the car. So the car doesn't change. You're just attaching a new magnet to the top. And that magnet in this case is the new spike protein, and the gain of function that's been achieved on that new spike protein. I want to give you this insight: is that many people have bashed the venom theory, and said I even had one person who's an esteemed sort of medical doctor in the community of people that are considered anti-vax, who's very well informed. I mean, she literally called this hooey. She said that venom is hooey. But behind closed doors, what I'm hearing from people that are in the know, especially toxicologists, is, wait, we knew there was venom on it. And in fact, maybe we wouldn't call it venom because we're toxicologists, and so venom is a form of toxin. So we're calling it toxin. If it doesn't come from a snake, if we didn't think about the way that venom needs to be injected, by the way, technically, if they really want me to be held to their definitions, right, a toxicologist, the venom on SARS-CoV-2 that spreads in infectious diseases technically would be a toxin. But if you take that toxin and you put it in an injection and you are injecting that as a vaccine, that's now venom. If they want to stick to their definition that a toxin that is injected is a venom, then the vaccines are the venom. And yeah. SARS-CoV-2 would be a toxin. I'm hoping that I get a round of applause from the toxicologist that would be like, oh yeah, he's right. That's that, I never thought about it like that. We only use venom from animals that can inject. Well, in this case, human animals, right? At your local pharmacy or wherever else in New Zealand that they're dishing this out now to kids, right? So that venom component, what I heard from toxicologists is, oh, well, we know this is a really horrible toxin. Oh, yeah, this is really shitty. And yes, we know it's a bangerotoxin. Oh, yes, we know it's neurotoxin. Oh, yes, we didn't really concentrate on the part. That's very interesting that you concentrated on the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. We should have. Oh, well done to you, Dr. Braun. You didn't get distracted by the ACE. Their ACE up their sleeve was talking about ACE receptors. That's only where this thing reproduces, right? Like, if you want to go and look out for, crime, sure, you could look in the brothel. That's the ACE receptor. That's where this thing is reproducing. But that's not the only place where the crime is taking place. I particularly wanted to choose other routes. And I looked at this from early videos out of Wuhan. And I said, this thing's acting like a nerve gas. Look at these people just dropping in the street. I am almost 50 years old. I have never seen anybody from a viral disease just fall over in a subway.
Again, I have to interrupt here as well and put forward the question because, there's like Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Tom Cowan, they talk about the whole fact that, even the way that virus virology or, the whole germ theory has been developed over the years, and the fact that you can't actually catch a virus, and this is kind of going down a whole nother route, but do you have a kind of response to that and the whole idea of terrain theory, which seems to me like what you're talking about, the acidity of the body that's created by carbohydrates or a high sugar diet, that actually can create a response in the body that is basically trying to get rid of a toxin.
Sure, but I'll take it one step further and say I'm just a simple guy. And one of the things that my brain allows, and I feel very privileged to have this brain, I particularly think it's a good brain, it's mine, and I'm biased. And I think it's a cool brain that allows me to make rapid connections between things. And I also sort of have the ability to visualize in a strange way where I see scale. And so we talk about these things, viruses, and we look at, you know, fuzzy electron microscope pictures because of the scale of how small they are. But a virus is a primitive jellyfish. That's all this thing is. I mean, if you think about it, we look at graphic design pictures, right? And you say you can't catch a virus, or there's, you know, you can't, viruses in that way don't exist. That would be like me saying, you know, and I'm a scuba diver. That would be like me saying, no, there's no jellyfish. Of course, viruses exist, and of course, bacteria exist, and of course, parasites exist. And by definition, a virus is an obligate parasite. It cannot reproduce without a host, right? And so that makes it a parasite. And if you think about the body being water, and if you think about different conditions, there's the reproduction of jellyfish are going to require certain circumstances to be correct for it, including it implanting on a reef, including it exploding and making, you know, these tiny polyps that go everywhere. Now, if you take the scale of that down, and if you simplify that, you'll land up with a tiny creature with a crown. And we only call it that because of how it looks, right? I mean, this is artistic interpretation. We call it a corona because it looks like a crown, because that's all we can see, because the thing is so tiny. But if you eventually, when the molecular models of this, that's why it looks different when it's drawn, right? Because the computational models of it, suddenly it looks much more like the creatures that we're aware of. Like, I don't know if anyone else noticed, but like the thing looks like a sea urchin, right?
That's the digital graphic that they're constantly putting up.
Right. And even that, so it makes that seem like it's this really hard, rigid thing. The closest match that I've seen to it visually is, and I don't know if they have them in New Zealand, but the sweet gum tree, you know, drops these the sweet gum seeds, and you have these sweet gum balls everywhere, and they're very, very resilient. I mean, they will lie around the whole season, and then unless someone comes and moves them out the way, they're just there, and they take a long time to decompose. So yes, when their graphic designer draws a coronavirus, that's a nice match, but you're dealing with slimy proteins, right? It's much more rigid in a picture. When you visualize this as a creature, when you visualize this as this jellyfish, then you realize why it can sting. Even the biologists are kind of weird in that they talk about the on-off switch of the spike protein. Well, the on-off switch of the spike protein means it's movable. It's on a hinge, right? I have yet to see any of these diagrams or any of the visual representations where that thing is moving like the creature that it is, like an urchin or like a jellyfish. And then you can really understand why it would be easy to attach protein to it, right? Because essentially all you're doing now is you're dipping. Let's say someone's going to fry up some calamari, right? You're just dipping it into a substance and it sticks. And so that's all they're doing. There's nothing fancy about being able to take something that already has a spike protein on it and add to it. So what have they added to it here that make it man-made? And why, and where I want to come back to is what the toxicologist finally said to me behind doors is, sure, we knew that this had toxin on it, right? But this is the scary part about a bioweapon. They haven't been concentrating on the venom. Why? Because they're more concerned about the HIV. They're more concerned about the rabies virus that's on it, right? They're more concerned about the super antigen on it that's in the staph family. So instead of them just really coming out over the last 2 years and saying, wow, this is the most horrible pathogenic substance we've ever looked at, we are horrified, we are scared, and there's no way we're putting this in our bodies. I mean, there was a reason the majority of these people didn't take the vaccine. I mean, Rochelle Walensky, and I don't know the equivalent in New Zealand, unfortunately, and no disrespect to the great people that are, you know, working this problem in New Zealand and would know the names better than me. But in the States, for example, Rochelle Walensky, she's the director of the CDC, but she's also the administrator of the toxin division, right? And so they should have been all over the news, toxicologists all over the world, and they should be the calling the alarm. They should be the ones saying, we know this is a bioweapon. We're looking at the HIV inserts. I read just before I came on to this interview, I was reading an article where it was bashing Senator Ron Johnson here from the States, going, you know, someone should call this person out for spreading misinformation. When somebody asked him about the vaccines causing AIDS, you know, he didn't just shoot that down and say, well, that's nonsense. Well, we know it's causing AIDS. It's got four HIV inserts on it. I mean, there are certain things that are indisputable biologically and scientifically that every person who's earning a living somewhere should just be honest about. The toxicologist should be screaming about the venom. Not me. I don't know a quarter of what, I mean, not even a quarter, less than that, a percentage of what they know about this. And yet I'm the one doing the interview and saying there's no way this should go into a child. And let's talk about, I am long-winded, but I come back to direct questions. And the direct question on who this affects and how it works. I believe that even if the statistic is something like 1 in 10,000, I think the adverse reaction that people are horrified over, you know, the clots that are immediate, the instant death for some people, the anaphylaxis in some people, I believe those are medical errors. I believe what's happening there is an old principle that you should never do an intramuscular vaccine without pulling back the plunger. It's called aspirating the needle, checking to see if you're in a vessel, but you never ever just shoot it up into a muscle because you could be hitting a vessel. And they don't do that practice anymore. Where they are doing that on places like China, where they are taught old school methods of pulling back the plunger. So I believe that the really horrible, very quick deaths and injuries that you're seeing, even if it's 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000, are coming through medical error. The second piece to it is that certain people are going to be at risk, whether it hits the muscle or the blood, in that we know now through great research, verified research using very, very high level spectrometry, we know that the vaccine, the mRNA, are not staying in the muscle like they said they were going to. We know it's hitting the plasma, indisputable. Every single subject that they looked at post-vaccine, it was in the blood. Now, for a lot of people, they are going to be able to be just fine with that circulating their body. And when I say fine, short term, but genetically, you're going to have people that are allergic to that ingredient. And not just the regular ingredients that they might be allergic to in the vaccine, they're going to be allergic to the proteins. This would be the equivalent of somebody that's highly allergic to gluten, and you give them an injection of mRNA protein that's going to reproduce gluten. There are people that are absolutely allergic to those proteins, right? Some of it you can see. So, for example, the spike protein is filled with glutamate. So as it replicates, it's going to cause an MSG-like substance, which means that a lot of people get headaches post-vaccine. That's they're having an allergic reaction to the glutamate. Now, can you know what proteins it's going to make? No, they're not going to tell you. What they give it is they give you a name of the mRNA that they're putting in you. And by the way, there's not just one. The patent for the vaccine has multiple variations of the spike protein, which starts feeding into what people are saying, where they're saying that the vaccine is not the same worldwide. Well, now this is starting to show, okay, well, that's very, very possible. And the name of the spike protein that's given is only the code, right? It doesn't give us the code of the proteins. And so nobody should be forced to take this whether they until somebody says, these are the ingredients. If they can tell you that it's got, you know, X, Y, and Z in it, but they don't tell you the rest of the ingredients, that no longer is informed consent.
Now, we are really getting pushed for time here. Would you like to finish up on the whole psychological aspect of it and moving forward and maybe giving people a bit of hope about how they can move through what is looking like a genocide?
I'd love to, and thank you for that invitation. So this is how we beat them. All right. We beat them in the way that we can know that we can easily see how they're beating us. They are dividing us. Right. They are literally dividing us. They are making us fight. I saw this during apartheid. They would go, the South African police would go and attack somewhere. And then the rumor would be spread that it was a certain tribe and that it wasn't that tribe. And the other tribe would attack that tribe. And so you create infighting. OK, we literally need to find ways where we make peace with each other and we find common points. And here's the thing about it. If you are that distant, now, value system wise, from friends and family, stop trying to win them over and stop trying to have this as some sort of logical argument. As somebody who's worked in psychiatric wards, if I went to work when I was an intern clinical psychologist in you know, chronic facilities, in acute wards, if I thought my job was to go and convince an insane person or somebody having a psychotic break that their reality was distorted, I would lose immediately. That's their reality. That's what they believe. You cannot break that irrational thought on both sides. What you can do is you can try and see if your value system is still intact, the things that you truly believe in. And for a lot of people, the value systems have moved to polar opposites. And I want to be, you know, you said bring hope. I want to say stop wasting your energy. The hope is that at some point things get so bad that people unify. That sounds like a really strange way of being hopeful. But sometimes things have to get so bad for people that they only then will unify as the oppositional force. And I believe that that's one of the things that's going to play out that allows us to defeat these people. The other aspect of giving people hope is that the principles here, as complex as they want to make this, you yourself in this interview showed people one of the solutions here. If somebody is sick with most diseases, but especially with coronavirus, sugar elimination is absolutely key. Now, I'm not telling a lot of people that sugar's the enemy and that sugar's the greatest, you know, pollutant on the planet. For some people, it might be. What I'm telling people that while they have the inability of metabolizing glucose, they need to stay away from sugar for the couple of days that their body is going through that cycle. Otherwise, they're adding to the toxicity problem. So I've seen this with my own eyes in terms of people that are struggling once they've been infected. Sugar elimination is absolutely key. So yeah, sugar is hidden in all kinds of things, including great electrolyte solutions where sugar is included, glucose is included. And so people need to be wary of what they're taking and make sure that that carbohydrate, sugar, even fruit is not ingested because it's going to add to the problem. From a philosophical place, the hope for us for our humanity is that at a core level, the things that are going to be the most important to us are going to be our future in terms of our children. And so there has been a lot of adults that would go along with this because it's been a threat to the way that they are perceiving the threat to themselves. And for them, they outweighed the risk of losing their job, okay, or losing friends and family. And what they looked at is, I will take this vile poison if it allows me to keep my friends and family. However, for a lot of people, that crosses the line when it comes to injuring their offspring, or more importantly, the potential of offspring. So for anybody who doesn't know that this affects fertility, they absolutely need to go and do their own homework and see that the highest load of these nanoparticles out of the studies in Japan was that they land up in the ovaries. And they also need to go and see that COVID absolutely for men affects the male reproductive organs. And that should be the giveaway that you then don't want to take that pathogen and put that pathogen in your body. So the long-term hope for all of us is that we can start turning the tide through information like we've spoken about today, where it is common sense and that we don't argue about it. We need to get to the point where we don't argue about things that are not philosophical or politicized. They're absolutely just factual. And then lastly, I want to say that a great hope for us is they are trying to strip us. And when I say they, those that want a one world system, those that want a one world currency, those that want a world that they can take back the control, you know, sort of the animals, the human animals were becoming too powerful. What they want from us is what we'll never give them, which is that our God-given right or our universal right as creatures on this planet is survivability through being empowered. So as long as we can keep solving the problem on our own, as long as we allow ourselves to be scientists without anybody saying you're a scientist, where as long as we take on the role of protector, as long as we take on the role of providing food, as long as we look after our offspring, they cannot win. So that is the hope for us, that part of regaining our power has never been lost.
Awesome. Yeah. And that's very much what we're talking about on the tour. Let's not forget who we really are and that we have the solutions. We have the answers. They've tried their perception deception to disempower us, to constantly hand ourselves over to the experts or hand ourselves over to those in control. And as long as we say, no, I'm going to take care of my own body. I'm going to take care of my own family. I'm going to provide for myself. Then they can't, their spell doesn't work over us anymore. So Dr. Tal Braun, thank you so much for joining us, bringing us information that Dr. Artis has also brought us. And of course, you've been doing this research for a couple of years. So it's great to see you getting out there doing interviews now as well. And I really hope that you get picked up all around the world because your information is fascinating and really an empowering message as well, that, you know, they may be psychopaths and they may be trying to exterminate us, but at the end of the day, we can win and we are powerful.
Well, here's my last message, and I haven't done this before. It's a message to the psychopaths. I've worked in a maximum security prison, and we get you. We finally get you. It doesn't matter how you run, doesn't matter how you fight. Psychopaths will always lose. There is always we catch up with the predator. We've done it throughout history, and we're going to do it again. So you can run, but you cannot hide. And my message on this interview is slightly different for anybody who's been on board with this. We're coming for you.
Awesome, love it. Thanks so much, and hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Hannah.
You can find Counterspin, New Zealand's media revolution, at counterspinmedia.com. And now, on the InfoWars Network, at band.video.